Italians turned them back into fireworks. By the second half of the 20th century, rockets were being launched that were powerful enough to carry people aloft. In a series of steps potentially as profound as the migration of life from the seas onto dry land, humans ventured into space. The advent of space flight lent new immediacy to an old question. If we can travel beyond our planet, couldn't the denizens of other planets come here, or be here already? Anyone who spends a lot of time looking at the night sky is likely sooner or later to see something he can't identify. I've seen a few myself. My most impressive sighting was of a V-shaped formation of white lights that moved through the sky silently at what seemed to be an incredibly high speed. Fortunately, I had a pair of binoculars around my neck, so I was able to get a closer look. And you know what they turned out to be? Birds. A flock of migrating birds, lights from a distant city lighting up their bellies to make perfect little oval flying saucers. If I hadn't had the binoculars handy, it would have been a mysterious UFO sighting. The question isn't just what we see, but how we interpret it. To claim that lights in the sky are alien invaders is like claiming that they're angels. It explains everything, and therefore it explains nothing. If we can hold off judgment until we have better information, we can distinguish more often between dubious and sound propositions and between birds and spaceships. When a real flying object unexpectedly shows up, like the bright meteor that crossed the western part of North America on the afternoon of August 10, 1972, or the one that passed over New York State on a Friday night in the fall of 1992, it typically results in much better pictures and more consistent eyewitness reports than has any alleged UFO sighting. And yet millions of people still believe that UFOs are alien spaceships. Why? Perhaps because we tend to project our deepest hopes and fears onto the sky, imagining that the aliens are warlike and dangerous, or that they're angelic benefactors who've come to save us from ourselves. In the classic 1951 science fiction film The Day the Earth Stood Still, Klaatu says, "Your choice is simple. Join us and live in peace, or pursue your present course and face obliteration. We shall be waiting for your answer. The decision rests with you." The Infosphere. No one has come to rescue us, and it's unlikely that anyone will show up soon. And that fact may be telling us something, that the best way to get in touch with intelligent extraterrestrials is not exploration, but communication, by sending not starships, but electronic signals across the interstellar seas. The idea of communicating with extraterrestrials has been in the air since at least the 19th century, when scientists suggested that we signal the Martians on a night when Mars passes near the Earth. Their proposal was to dig a giant triangle in Siberia, flood it with kerosene, and set the trenches afire. The Martians would recognize the triangle as a symbol of Euclidean geometry, a sure sign of intelligent life on Earth. In a modern version of the flaming triangle, the Chinese artist Cai Guozhang ignited a 10,000-meter-long gunpowder fuse extended from one end of the Great Wall of China. He called the installation Project for Extraterrestrials. Cai's work reinvents the partnership of fireworks and exploration, but for sending real messages through space, radio communication works better. Radio can carry words, numbers, and pictures cheaply and at the velocity of light. The almost miraculous speed with which radio carries messages prompted even the earliest pioneers of radio technology to imagine using this wonderful new device to communicate with other worlds. Guglielmo Marconi, inventor of radio, picked up what he thought might be radio pulses from space, and Nikola Tesla claimed that he too had received extraterrestrial signals. Tesla generated powerful electrical bursts at his laboratory in Colorado Springs and fancied that the resulting radio noise could be received on other planets. These imagined receptions were replaced by the real thing in 1931, when a Bell Telephone Company engineer named Carl Jansky accidentally detected the radio energy emitted naturally by clouds of hydrogen gas in the Milky Way. Grote Reber, an amateur radio enthusiast, then built the world's first true radio telescope, a metal dish 31 feet in diameter in the backyard of his home in Wheaton, Illinois, and used it to map the Milky Way. Today, radio telescopes record the murmur of interstellar gas clouds, the pulses of rapidly spinning neutron stars, and the screams of colliding galaxies. Earth has been inadvertently broadcasting to the stars for decades. The television premiere of Life Beyond Earth was one such broadcast. It reached the planet Saturn in an hour and a half and continued into deep space. A sphere of radio and television broadcasts surrounds our planet. Its radius is nearly 100 light-years, and it's expanding at the speed of light. 1,000 stars lie within the sphere of radio and TV broadcasts that have leaked into space from Earth. If there are any listeners out there, they could, in theory, intercept these broadcasts. The farther they are from us, the older the news they're receiving. Alpha Centauri is a star only 4 light-years away. So Earth's broadcasts reaching Alpha Centauri today are only 4 years old. The star Capella is 40 light-years away. If anyone's listening there, what they're hearing from Earth are the hits of the 50s. The golden age of jazz is just dawning at Beta Pictoris, a star that shows evidence of having planets forming around it. Any radio buffs at Mizar, a star in the handle of the Big Dipper, are in a position just about now to be picking up Earth's very first broadcasts. We're leaking radio messages into space, and the inhabitants of other planets, if they exist, might be doing the same thing. Large radio telescopes on Earth could detect such radio leaks from civilizations in nearby star systems, as well as stronger signals dispatched intentionally by planets thousands of light-years away. This realization is the keystone of SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. Some scientists doubt that there are any intelligent beings out there. One of their arguments is called Fermi's question. It's named for the Italian physicist Enrico Fermi, who asked, "Where are they?" His point was that technologically advanced aliens, if they exist, should have visited Earth already. Since they evidently have not, they don't exist. I performed an experiment to test the validity of Fermi's question. At home alone one night, I decided to have lobster for dinner. So I set a place, opened the door to the street, and waited for a lobster to show up and crawl onto my plate. Hours passed. At 11 p.m., I ended the experiment. No lobster had appeared, so I concluded there are no lobster on Earth. Since we know that lobster do exist, clearly there was something wrong with my reasoning. The error was, of course, that I'd failed to take the lobster's preferences into account. Lobster have their own agenda. They don't want to come to my house. But the fact that they don't show up doesn't mean they don't exist. As the SETI scientists like to say, absence of evidence isn't evidence of absence. Suppose we had an atlas that devoted but one page to each planet in the Milky Way galaxy. That's a lot of planets. To page just once through all the volumes of this atlas, glancing at one planet per second, day and night, would take over 10,000 years. As the historian Thomas Carlyle said, contemplating the prospect of billions of worlds, if they be inhabited, what a scope for misery and folly. If they not be inhabited, what a waste of space. At astronomical observatories like Keck on the island of Hawaii, astronomers are finding evidence of planets orbiting nearby stars. Astronomer Paul Butler says,
"We only want to know two things. What fraction of stars have planets, and what fraction of those planetary systems are similar to our own solar system?" It wasn't until the early part of this century that it even became technically feasible to begin looking for planets around other stars.
Astronomer Jeffrey Marcy says,
"Our technique involves watching a star to see how it is gravitationally pulled by its attendant planets. And an Earth-like planet is simply too small to yank around its host star. But a Jupiter, being some 300 times more massive than an Earth-like planet, does have enough gravitational oomph to yank its star around. And so for the moment, all we can detect are Jupiters and maybe Saturn-like planets. We watch the star night after night, month after month, and if the star does wobble, it must be doing so because a planet is pulling on it. It's a little bit like a dog owner having a little poodle on the end of a leash. the poodle, being very low mass, can still yank its owner around if the poodle goes around in circles. And in this case, the low mass planets can yank around the star. In the case of a poodle, of course, the leash is this leather tether. In the case of the planets, the leash is gravity.
We look for very teeny shifts in the spectrum that tell us that, in fact, the star is wobbling in space. It is moving alternately towards us and away from us. If the star is moving towards you, its entire spectrum will be shifted to the blue, and if the star is moving away from you, then the star will be shifted to the red.
Future telescopes operating in space could be linked together to create the equivalent of a lens larger than the Earth. Such orbiting observatories might be able to detect signs of life on the planets of nearby stars. Telescopes have incited speculation about extraterrestrial life ever since the summer night 400 years ago when Galileo first trained a telescope on the sky. Galileo called the universe a great book written in the characters of geometrical figures. This was a revolutionary idea. The books that mattered in Galileo's day were the ones written by ancient authorities like Aristotle and Ptolemy. They said that the universe was a kind of nutshell with the Earth at its center, and that the sun and planets were ethereal wafers pasted on the inside of the shell. In that kind of universe, there could be no life on other worlds because there were no other worlds. The stars and planets were like the decorations on the insides of the great cathedrals, beautiful, pristine, nearby, and useless. But when Galileo turned a telescope on the sky, he found that the planets and the moon don't look like wafers. They look like rotund worlds, resembling the Earth in some ways. And when he looked at the sun, he found that it wasn't perfect, but was besmirched by sunspots. As Galileo observed the sun in Florence week after week, he could see the sunspots, which are giant magnetic storms on the surface of the sun, moving across the solar disk. Not the behavior of a flat, static object, but, as we would say today, of a rotating ball of plasma, a star. Galileo's observations blew the roof off the universe. Aristotle, to the contrary, the Earth is not the only world bounded in a starry nutshell. It's one among many worlds, and there's no nutshell at all. The sun is a star, and every star is a sun. The mathematical laws of nature that pertain here on Earth work everywhere else as well. So if there's life here, why not out there? Galileo's experiments touched off a scientific revolution that awakened humankind to the possibility of life beyond Earth. In Germany, Johannes Kepler identified the laws that govern the motion of the planets. Kepler found that planets move faster when close to the sun and slower when farther away, in just such a way that their orbits always sweep out equal areas in equal times. This is a genuinely universal law, true of any object in orbit, from the moons of Jupiter to the planets of distant stars. In England, Isaac Newton showed that Kepler's laws result from the force of gravitation exerted by the Earth and every other massive object. It is by using Newton's equations that today's space navigators are able to put probes into orbit around Venus, Mars, and Jupiter. In the 20th century, Albert Einstein cleared up disparities in Newton's theory by composing a broader account of gravitation